Jeffrey O'Brien has tried to remember the images and shared desires of the 1960s, the period of the spy craze when the parents sat on the couch reading The Spy Who Came In from the Cold and the kids watched I Spy on TV, when everyone wore wraparound sunglasses, when teenagers in the cities and the suburbs got intense, when drugs were the fundamental text, and if you hadn't read the book, you couldn't participate in the discussion that followed. O'Brien's new book is titled Dreamtime, Chapters from the 60s. It's not an official history. He's a poet, and he's more interested in recalling texture than in restating fact. O'Brien is also a critic who writes about poetry, fiction, and film for the New York Review of Books and The Village Voice. His 1981 book, Hard-Boiled America, is a history of crime fiction and lurid paperbacks. I asked Jeffrey O'Brien why he wanted to write a meditation on the 1960s.
In about 1981, at which point I had just finished writing a book about crime fiction of the 40s and 50s, I looked around and suddenly the 60s seemed to be a rapidly receding memory. And I found that my own memories of the time were growing dim, mainly because at that point the media were maintaining a kind of general silence on the subject. So I thought it might be interesting to try to capture some of that atmosphere before it disappeared altogether. I started going to the library and systematically rereading newspapers from the period and was startled by the flood of memories that came back. I was reading advertisements, anything, any scraps at all. The most trivial things would set off all kinds of chain reactions. So I began to take notes, and it gradually became a book.
I like the word atmosphere. You were trying to capture the atmosphere of the 60s. I think that is really what you were trying to do, as opposed to the politics or the lifestyle. It was really atmosphere that you're going after.
Yes, well, we know the official story. We get periodic reruns of that, but it becomes rather difficult to remember the rather intense atmospherics of that time.
So you're writing about the 60s. You were born in 1948. So
yes.
During that decade, you ranged in age from 12 to 22.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to read a passage toward the opening of the book. And this is a little bit about growing up as a child in suburbia.
Yes.
In the 60s.
They lived in a civilization that brought them things. They could count on a new crop of toys each Christmas, always a little more technologically advanced than last year's models. Tin robots that spoke and walked, plastic rockets with a range of up to 30 feet. New television programs were provided each September to set the tone for that autumn's play, whether the props were Davy Crockett hats or Zorro capes or a rifle like Chuck Connors used. Life was to be a succession of surprise presents from the entertainment companies. With the same regularity that the world produced new snow, new tulips, or new calendar years, there would always be new games, new dress-up disguises, new launchers and new wired tracks, new jokes, new adventure stories, exciting new designs on packages of bubblegum. Life in the future was going to be fun, and American kids were going to have the most fun of all. There would be telephones with picture screens. People would live on the moon under bubble domes. Electronic ramps would glide noiselessly into vast silos. Everything would be shiny and in bright colors. The future had a style all its own.
Now, what was the style of the future to you when you were growing up?
Well, I suppose it owed a lot to Walt Disney and Life magazine.
The World's Fair.
And just the general prosperity of those years, certainly in the suburbs, everything looked rather new.
Did you think of yourself as belonging to one of the most privileged generations of kids?
Well, certainly that was the message that was drummed home in school, as I recall. That was, after all, supposed to be why America had such a tremendous advantage over the Russians and everybody else. Because of our unparalleled material wealth.
But did your parents frequently tell you that life wasn't meant to be fun? When they thought that you expected too much fun out of life?
Well, I think that actually the atmosphere of that time was fairly hedonistic. certainly among the middle class.
In the reading that you just did, you ran through some of the toys, the entertainment-generated
yes.
objects. What were some of the images of that period that had the reverse effect and that really scared you?
Well, gradually one was told about the atom bomb, for example. That crept out in science fiction movies, in periodic television programs, which might simulate a Russian bombing of Portland, Oregon, for example, in civil service, civil defense warnings, rather, and the fallout shelter campaign. So all of this was presented as discreetly as possible, but nevertheless, the basic idea did get through, despite all of the rather euphemistic language that surrounded it.
It's interesting that there's objects throughout your book. You know, you're always talking about advertisements or brand names or kinds of sunglasses that
yes.
people are wearing. Why do those images conjure up so much for you? And why are they so important to you to include so much of that in your book?
Oh, I suppose because modern American culture seems to me to be the ultimate materialist civilization. I don't think there's ever been anything quite like it, really.
You know, something that really struck me when I started reading your book is that on the same page that you discussed the Kennedy assassination, you were talking about the Elizabeth Taylor version of Cleopatra.
Yes.
And, you know, those two events will always be wedded in my mind. No, because my parents had tickets for Cleopatra. It was such a big, it was such a big epic, such a ballyhooed affair that you had to buy advance tickets in New York.
Yes.
So my parents had bought tickets for it, and then like 2 days before they were supposed to go see it, Kennedy was assassinated, and it was a big ethical dilemma. Do you go to the movies after a president's been assassinated?
Yeah.
And so those two events will always be together in my mind, and I thought it was so interesting. The only place I've ever seen them connected before is in the pages of your book.
Yeah, because
it's kind of coincidental, I guess, that they're there.
Yeah, they sort of ran in tandem, because when Kennedy went on television at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the headlines on the paper that day were all about Liz and Dick and Eddie Fisher. So that that was the show that was interrupted, so to speak. And gradually people got back to that show. I have the sense that after Kennedy's assassination, there was this strange sort of party that began, which was an almost hysterical reaction to that, as if everyone was just desperate to have some fun and forget about all this for a while.
Now, how did that affect you? You were still a preteen.
Well, it was all very exciting. It was a great media event, and to be young was to be in the thick of it, because one of the major points of it all was youth.
Were you dying to be a teenager, to be part of teen culture?
Well, not especially, but I found myself there anyway. At that point, it became rather irresistible, because the culture at large had such an obsession with youth that it was kind of like being the center of attention at all times, very, very gratifying and ultimately fairly corrupting, I would think.
My guest is Jeffrey O'Brien, whose new book is titled Dreamtime, Chapters from the 60s. And It's about the atmosphere of the 1960s. I'm going to ask you to read another
sure.
passage from your book. And this is really about being in high school and having a sense of a separate culture, a sense that we're different from the
yes.
rest of the culture.
Yes. What I was really trying to talk about here was the way middle-class teenagers gradually initiated themselves into the drug culture and the rock culture and what was then the underground. So this passage is a kind of free associative attempt to duplicate the kind of conversation that you might have going on. All that's really needed is a place to talk. Talk can go on forever. The new Stone song is about amphetamine, is about condoms, is tough. They sing flat. It sounds great. That riff at the end. Barbara thinks she is hip, but she isn't. Hip people do not read fashion magazines. They read the Pocket Poet series. They don't read. They taunt the police and play loud music. Are you afraid? Does it sound too dangerous? The fugs are going to be in Tompkins Square. The words are obscene. The new teacher is a real fascist. He's prissy. We were accused of smoking in the bathroom. Linda is not a virgin. William Burroughs is serious. I'm upset about my self-image, about my mother, about feeling ghost-like. Did you hear what I dreamed? We made love in the middle of a burning bus. Sex should be honest and free, should be independent of race and creed. Her cousin was taken by the doctor and measured. It sounds so disgusting. The scars are from slashing her wrists. The new Stone song is about what Camus meant when he talked about suicide. There is only one truly serious philosophical question, and that is suicide. An empty heart is like an empty life. Have you ever felt like that? I feel like that all the time. I feel like that right now. We are going to create a conspiracy of high school students. A secret nation will be created out of all the hip people meeting after school, smuggle in wine and illicit books, have clandestine meetings in the library, use certain words and buttons as codes. I could work as a waitress, and we could rent a house and live in it together. What fun we'd have. Can you imagine a world invented by us?
You know what you kind of captured in there that I find interesting? This sense of not only starting to have a separate language and a separate subculture and everything, but a sense of despair and an obsession with suicide.
Well, yes, it wasn't all fun. The fun was more in the media, perhaps, than in the actual reality, certainly for teenagers.
But it's interesting to think about why so many young people at that time didn't really take their own lives, but felt really alienated and, into despair and into talking about suicide.
Well, as to why that...
Does it describe you? Were you into despair?
It was a style, yeah, certainly. If you had any pretensions to being an intellectual, it certainly was the style of the time.
But of course, it was more than style, too. I mean, I don't want to make light of it. I mean, those are genuine feelings.
Oh, absolutely. But I think what happened then a few years later, coming out of California, you had this wave of optimism that was associated with hippies, which was really quite a revolution. It was suddenly saying that, well, no, we're not talking about despair anymore. We're talking about creating a happy new world, and everybody is going to be grooving. And that was a radical attempt to change the tone. But somehow in New York, which is where most of my book is centered, it never really took hold. The New York style was always a bit more down.
But it's interesting, you know, that the way you write about how the tone changes once a lot of people start taking acid, and the tone gets more optimistic, and the new slang is as unsarcastic as possible.
Yes,
you write.
Yes.
Were you ever accused of being too sarcastic by friends of yours?
Well, I think that there was this attempt, really, to engage in a sort of self-brainwashing and get rid of a lot of ego hang-ups, which meant really sort of trying to transform oneself into a kind of Zen monk or perhaps some extraterrestrial being full of wisdom. And the attempt, obviously, was not usually successful.
Did you go through different selves in the 60s? Recreate yourself and shed old selves?
Oh, I think everybody did. When I say everybody, of course, I should emphasize that the Dreamtime does not attempt to cover everything that was going on in the 60s. It has very little to say about civil rights or Vietnam or many other things that were happening. What I'm trying to talk about really is the pleasure culture that flourished then and became for a time very central to a lot of people.
Let me ask you to read one other thing. You're talking about the pleasure culture, and you've talked before about all the mass marketed
yes.
items. And there's you describe the point at which a lot of the style associated with hippies in the counterculture became part of mass marketing.
Yes.
Would you read that?
Yeah, here I'm trying to describe the degradation, as it were, of the kind of imagery which had surfaced with the psychedelic culture, which had been a genuine underground, which suddenly flooded into the American media and was adopted with great rapidity. So that inside of about 4 or 5 months, these things had become cliches and had become altogether transformed. So this is the hippie who suddenly finds himself at a loss to know what's going on, because all of his favorite symbols have been more or less co-opted by advertising. You parachute into a country without maps. The rule of the road becomes any visible sign is already outmoded. The flowers that were weapons against state and army now enhance the marketability of toilet paper and deodorants. Dayglow announces a mafia-owned tavern. The archetypal flower girl, against a background of Indian cotton blankets and Jimi Hendrix music, goes through the numbed paces of the pornographic loops. If someone says he wants to tell it like it is, he is probably running for Congress. Tripster glasses and strobe lamps are sold in the little mail-order ads in the back of comic books, alongside whoopee cushions and rubber spiders. The only hippies making the papers now are not dancing but dead, overdosed, suicided, murdered. Flowers and wiggly demons from a dead girl's notebook become the first examples of psychedelic art to make it into the New York Times. The quickie movies of Roger Corman, Sam Katzman, and Samuel Z. Arkoff, The Trip, The Lovin's, Psych Out, The Hallucination Generation, are busy converting pastel and paisley shades into basic supermarket neon. At the same time, the icon of the angelic hippie, that sensitive creature attuned to barely perceptible wavelengths of tenderness, is translated for Hollywood's purposes into either a grunting delinquent, Mary Jane, Coogan's Bluff, or the effete prey of barbarian motorcyclists in Angels from Hell, or, at best, the sincere but confused teenager struggling towards social maturity in The Young Runaways. And the drugs, once the only sure guides, the breviaries to which one might turn for instruction, are tainted. The pot has sugar in it. The acid is shot through with amphetamine. It's as if God had been poisoned.
Were you as upset by all of that as you sound in the book? Was this upsetting to you personally?
There was a certain amount of naivete about what was going on, because nothing like this had ever happened before, certainly to young people. And it did seem for about 10 minutes that a new world was coming to birth, so that the shock was considerable, yes.
My guest is writer Jeffrey O'Brien, and we're discussing his new book, Dreamtime, Chapters from the 60s, which is really a meditation on the 60s. We'll talk more with him about this, and also about crime fiction, which is the subject of his earlier book, Hardboiled America, after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey O'Brien is my guest. I think everybody who sits down and thinks about the 60s has a demarcation point at which the 60s end for them. It's usually not like the calendar year. It's like some event or some memory. For yours, it's paranoia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You want to explain?
Sure. Well, after all, there was this tremendous expansion, sometimes chemically inspired or religiously or politically inspired, or all three at once. And after that, it came a kind of crumpling effect. And the result was frequently absolute paranoia. I can remember when the East Village Other, New York's underground newspaper, suddenly stopped running flowers on the cover and had an all-black cover with words to the effect, love is dead. And that was about early 1968, I believe. That was more or less the point at which the tide seemed to start going the other way, so that one no longer felt that one was so much marching into the future as rather desperately trying to maintain a few vestiges of this lovely vision that had existed briefly.
You know, in talking about the 1960s, we've left out certainly one very essential part of your life, and that was reading crime fiction.
Oh, yes.
Reading detective novels. And that's the subject of your earlier book,
yes.
Hard-Boiled America. You say at age 15 you were reading crime fiction. That would be in the early to mid-60s.
Yes.
Now, that really didn't fit in with the mainstream pop stuff of the time, or the pop stuff of your generation, really. What got you interested in reading that?
Well, in fact, in the 60s, there was a great deal of rediscovery going on of Hollywood movies, certainly of the 30s and 40s. The Humphrey Bogart cult was in full swing, which was more or less how I got involved with writers like Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett. So that interest did exist. Of course, at that time, those books were rather hard to come by. Since then, they've pretty much returned to print and have been succeeded by many other writers like Jim Thompson, who at that time were completely unknown.
Now, I see a connection, I don't know if you'll agree with this or not, between crime fiction and your book on the 60s, and that is the sense of bohemia, the sense of this place that's outside of mainstream society. Because all the characters in crime fiction are out of the mainstream. Now, they're all either like cops, detectives, or criminals, but they're still not living the ordinary middle-class kind of life.
Sure. Well, people have to believe that there's a place where the real stuff is going on in some sort of hidden place. And I think that's most of what this is about. It's an attempt to eavesdrop on where reality is really happening.
You've grown up to be a literary critic and a poet. Did growing up really loving crime fiction help to set the tone for the kind of literary criticism you write now, in terms of what you take seriously?
I never had any trouble taking crime fiction seriously, certainly not after reading people like Chandler and Hammett. It all seems to fit right in with the great melodramatic traditions, certainly, of Western writing. It's really just the latest installment, as it were.
I've been watching a lot of television reruns lately.
Yes.
And thinking about how we don't sometimes notice style until we're past the decade that style's part of. Specifically, mm-hmm. watching some TV reruns from the late 70s, I realized how wide the collars were, how thick the sideburns were. Who notices then? I thought it was,
yeah.
Who noticed it? It didn't seem like people were wearing weird collars. Do you feel that way looking back on the 60s, which you've done for your book, that you can now notice things that wouldn't have been apparent when you lived through it?
Well, the strange thing about the 60s, though, and it's something I tried to emphasize in Dreamtime, was the extraordinary self-consciousness of people, and the fact that people really were creating an illusion about the decade as it happened, this image was created on the spot, as it were. People really had the sense that they were inventing something extraordinarily new and adventurous, and they really wanted the world to know about it. So that the legend was really manufactured on the spot in a way that makes the 50s look like a rather sleepy period. It was when the 60s looked back at the 50s that suddenly the 50s seemed very, very strange indeed. And people were saying, my God, people really used to sit around and watch that sort of program and live that sort of life. And then, of course, the 70s and the 80s came and people seemed to have settled back into doing more or less what they were doing in the 50s, and it's the 60s that suddenly seems slightly strange for the moment, perhaps.
We've had to take stock of the life you lived in the 1960s. There's actually a little bit of a nostalgia business around the 1960s now. Do you want any part of that? Do you want to see the 60s nostalgically?
Well, people will obviously try to remember the nice bits leave out the actual paranoia. And really, I think if certainly most of the people I know, if given a chance to relive the 60s, might well have second thoughts about it. It certainly was no picnic all the way through.
Are there any artifacts from the 60s that you've saved, that you went back to when you were writing your new book? Toys, posters, books?
Well, in fact, I had saved almost nothing, and I found that many of the things I wanted to look at have become extremely rare. All of the underground newspapers that I had hoped to look through were very hard to find. But I did, as I rummaged through various secondhand bookstores, come across all sorts of strange little pamphlets and books, things by Timothy Leary on how to form your own religion, and books about the Maharishi and various various other groups, so that I was able to feel my way back into that extraordinary rhetoric, which was one of the things that I most wanted to get at in Dreamtime, was this sort of Baroque splendor of people inventing new languages and new jargon and new systems of the universe every 10 minutes, which is something that people seem to... Well, now it's pretty much relegated to the so-called New Age movement, but that strikes me as being just slightly different.
Do you feel more alert to the 80s now that you've looked back at another decade?
Yes, well, obviously since I sat down to write this book, the 80s themselves have gone through many changes. As I say, when I began Dreamtime, there was a kind of official silence going on about the 60s, and now everybody seems to want to remember it, which may be some indication that people are getting a little bit tired of the 80s and wondering what the next wave is going to bring.
Are you afraid they're going to remember the made-for-TV version of the 60s instead of the real thing?
Well, certainly those who weren't there will rely on the made-for-TV version. I would hope that the people that were actually there might try to recall the actual messiness of it a little more accurately.
Okay. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been writer Jeffrey O'Brien. He's the author of Hard-Boiled America, which is a book about crime fiction. And his new book is titled Dreamtime, Chapters from the 60s, and it's just been published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.